Morning. Today's Wednesday, February 23rd, 1991. It's 8:32. The House State Affairs Committee meeting. We're going to go into a work session. The first session to hear from Dave Rhodes, Executive Director of the Permanent Fund Corporation, and Jim Kelly. Want to join us at the table? We're not on teleconference for this section, so don't worry about the mic. And good morning. Thank you for taking the time to come visiting with us, and we're going to be real informal. You just whip it on us.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dave Rhodes, the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We'll try and keep it informal, and I do want you to break in and ask any questions if you have any. What we prepared this morning is really a presentation in three parts, or two parts, really. One is to run through some briefing charts that we have, which is in this document. And we'll just sequentially go through it and talk a little bit about what the fund has done and what it's doing. Secondly, there's a packet under the letterhead of the Senate Finance Committee, in which they had asked us specific questions relating to what we were doing with respect to the operations of the fund as a result of the Mideast crisis. And I thought perhaps I might just run through that and let you know a couple of the things that we are doing. But other than that, we'd be pleased to answer questions either as we go along or at the end. With me on my right is Jim Kelly. Jim Kelly is our legislative and public liaison officer. Jim is a fellow who, in my absence, answers an awful lot of the questions and tries to be responsive to legislative and executive branch requests as well as public requests. And Jim, feel free to interrupt if you think I've lost my mind on something. Excuse me, I've got the sniffs this morning, but to start off, on page two of this handout is the constitutional amendment, which was adopted in 1976. Just two short sentences, but you'll notice that they use the word permanent fund three times. So we're not setting up a temporary fund, we're setting up a permanent fund. The idea being that the principle remains inviolate and exists in perpetuity. However, the earnings really flow to the benefit of the state legislature, and they can be appropriated as the legislature sees fit. The constitutional amendment says that all income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. There has been another provision by law which sets up the earnings reserve account as an account within the permanent fund. And so that acts as sort of an estoppel to the flow to the general fund. But notwithstanding the fact that there isn't a direct flow to the general fund, there's a flow to the earnings reserve account, which is a fund managed by the permanent fund, but not part of the principal of the fund. The legislature may appropriate all of the earnings out of that earnings reserve account each year, either for dividends, for inflation proofing, or any other lawful and legal purpose. So while the principle is inviolate, the earnings of the permanent fund really are at the disposal of the legislature. And indeed, while the beneficiaries of the permanent fund are generally considered to be the people of the state of Alaska, and generally that's what our propaganda indicates, in a true legal sense, the beneficiaries of the fund is the state legislature. The state legislature only can appropriate that income, whether it be for dividends or back to the fund for inflation proofing or for some other purpose.
Do we actually pass a bill every year on the dividends?
Yes, every year the narrative part of the budget, the first part of the budget, will carry five or six or seven individual paragraphs dealing with permanent fund appropriations. To appropriate not only money for inflation proofing and for dividends, but also to appropriate the new money that we receive from the oil patch, to appropriate money from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund, if it's necessary, or to the permanent fund for use if our earnings are not sufficient to meet dividends and inflation proofing. But there is a whole regimen of narrative statements on the first couple pages of the budget that deal with all of these matters. Turning to page two, or rather page three as it's listed here, chart three indicates that over the years since inception, 1977 to 1990, About $33.2 billion has been received from the state in oil revenue. Now, $6.5 billion of that has been saved in the permanent fund. We can account, I can assure you, for every penny of that. The $26.7 billion that has been spent, of course, is without our jurisdiction, and we couldn't begin to tell you what's happened to that. But the important part of the chart is that fully 20% of all of the money that has flowed to the state from oil revenues has been saved. And that's a very credible amount. You know, there's a lot of legislative bashing, and sometimes Alaskans like to beat up on each other. But when you consider that 20% of all that money actually has been saved, is in the bank and can be accounted for, that's a very credible piece of financial management. I know there are some who would like to have saved more. There are some who would like to have saved less. But 20% is a pretty darn good historical record. When you look at petroleum revenues in general, chart 4 shows the over the years how much of the money from oil has gone to the general fund and how much to the permanent fund. This chart may throw you off a bit because as you read the constitutional amendment, it says 25% of oil revenues go to the fund, but those are bonuses and royalties. No tax money goes to the permanent fund. So that when you take a look at total revenues, including taxes, roughly about 10% of everything that the state has taken in goes to the permanent fund. 10% of all of the take, including taxes. But the permanent fund really only receives non-tax money, bonuses, royalties, etc., and it gets 25% of that money. So if you hear a 25% figure and a 10% figure, it's 25% of the bonuses, royalties, etc. But of the total amount of monies that flow in, it's roughly 10%. This chart indicates, of course, that we had a lot of money flowing in the early years. Now, as we begin to pump less and less oil at lower and lower prices, you'll see that that take will diminish, both in terms of the general fund as well as the permanent fund. Page 5 indicates what's happened to the two different funds. One, the money produced by the state oil revenues on the left, again, $33.2 billion. $6.5 has been saved and added to the permanent fund, and $26.7 has been spent. The chart on the right, the fund, has earned $6.9 billion since its inception. Of that, $3.4 billion, has been added to the fund principal in terms of both inflation proofing and special appropriations of earnings. $2.9 billion has been paid out in terms of dividends and a little bit of general fund money. And $600 million still remains residual in the account as reserves. These are the reserves that are unencumbered, they can be appropriated, or they can be left as they are, as they currently have been. This chart, on chart 6, sort of tells you the whole story of the state of Alaska. While we have substantial revenues coming in from tourism and mining and fishing and timber, the two income producers in the state of Alaska are really oil and the fund. These are the two real producers of money. As you can see, there will be a point, a crossover point, unless ANWR or some other major field comes online, where fund income will start to be greater than the amount of income produced by oil. And we're fast approaching those dates. As the fund grows and oil diminishes, there will be a crossover point. And even though we have a lot of economic development factors, such as tourism and mining and all the others I mentioned, these two elements really dominate the state and will dominate the state for the near term.
Mr. Chairman, what year does that line cross there?
We did it stylistically so that, because we didn't want to say, it looks like about 93, Jim.
It varies between 93 and 97, depending on what the latest oil revenue forecast says.
Because that's why we didn't label the bars, because we wanted to be imprecise.
I wanted to figure out whether I was still in office there.
Recognizing this is stylistic, nonetheless, Dave, but what happened in the year when there was a big blip?
I'll talk a little bit about those. Those were 2 years when the fund had unusual market operations. In 86, we had an awful lot of paper profits in bonds. And so we sold those bonds, took the profits in cash, because this is a cash chart. And then when we took those profits and bonds, we went and invested the money in the stock market. And then in 87, before the crash, we sold a lot of our stock and took a lot of profits. So that's a blip from a sale of bonds in 86 and a big blip from the sale of stock in 87. Not normal, clearly. And those were strictly market operations. That may happen once in a decade. We loved it when it happened, but you know, we generally are not market players. We don't, you know, we don't get in there and really swing with the heavy-duty market timers, etc. But you will have flips like that.
Mr. Chairman, is there any relationship to the fact that oil revenues took a dip the other direction that year, for those 2 years?
Mr. Chairman, there is in the sense that the permanent fund is invested counter-cyclical to the state's fortunes. We are very heavily concentrated in bonds. And bonds are inflation sensitive. When it looks like inflation is going to go up, let's say when oil prices are very high, your fortunes fall very dramatically if you're in the bond market. However, if it looks like oil prices are going to fall, a deflating effect on the national economy, because obviously if oil is cheap and industry has to pay less for energy, profits will be higher. If oil falls, then bonds do extremely well. Well, the blip you see in the chart of the period when the oil prices fell dramatically, the state general fund income dropped from about $4 billion to about $2 billion. At that same time, the permanent fund was just blowing its top because it had invested in bonds, and the bonds were extremely valuable. So that counter-cyclical effect will give you exactly what you see here. I'm not sure we really did that by design or default, but we do try to some degree not to be invested in exactly what Alaska is. We're not heavy into oil and energy and things like that.
Well, and in fact, it's still the case, even now, in the last several months, that the price of oil has gone up and come down dramatically. We've gone the opposite direction both times. The worse it is for oil, the better it is for us, and vice versa.
If, for example, well, yeah, that's too tangential. Let's go to chart 7. We have what we call an asset allocation, and this really in English just means it's the way we allocate the assets that we're going to invest. The long-term plan is to have 55% of the fund invested in marketable debt securities and fixed income, 10% in commercial real estate, 25% in U.S. equities and stock, and 10% international stock. This is a plan that would be followed up until 1993. Unless the new board of directors that has just come on board changes it, this will be the plan that will be continued on from the old board. The new board met for the last 2 days. They'll meet again in March. The expectations are that this will not change, that this policy and plan will continue in effect without abatement, so that as the years go on, as we get closer to June of 1993, this is sort of the profile that you will see. The profile today is much higher in fixed income and much lower in stock.
Dave, you bring up two questions in my mind. One is the new board. Do you have any comments on, you may not, the appropriateness of the governor to remove the entire board?
That probably, you know, more politic than whatever. I have met the last 2 days with the new board. I am very, very impressed by their acumen, their drive. I don't see any real major changes. And I know a lot of folks in Alaska have been concerned because it's been a 100% turnover, which is sort of unusual. But all of these folks for the last 2 days talked a little bit about stability and continuity of policy. All of them seem to be very sensitive to the fact, because they are new, that people are concerned. And just because of that concern, they seem to be saying, you know, we just want to see what's going on. We want to do the best we can to assist the staff and the organization. And I don't perceive any real major shifts at all. And we did have 2 very full days with these folks, so I think that's a plus.
But you venture to try to bring you out a little bit more. Some of us feel that for this fund, you made a statement about it's political, and that's exactly probably the point I'm getting at is, wouldn't it not be better if the governor just removed it at the time those slots were open, and therefore that would not be as political?
I think from a our standpoint, we try very desperately not to have the fund politicized. And because we are a $12 billion player in domestic and international markets, we like the external view of the fund, both with the citizenry in Alaska and all over the world, to be one of stability, of continuity. And there was no question about the fact that this action unnerved a lot of people, both the people we deal with internationally as well as the folks in Alaska. We probably could have done without that appearance of instability, because we try very hard to paint the picture of stability at all times. And I think perhaps that's the best I have to say about it.
Well, let me bring up a different point then. You have your allocation here. Some people think that the permanent fund should be invested in Alaska. Something that the banks have the ability to draw upon for, say, small or medium business loans, things like this. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we have several Alaska programs, one of which is what we call a bank certificate of deposit program, which is a $300 million allocation. This works in a way that any bank in Alaska can step up and ask to draw money. They don't have to bid for it. The money cost is the 90-day Treasury bill rate plus 0.75%. It's open and available to any bank who wants to step up and ask for the money as well as put up collateral. The collateral that the bank would have to put up is generally equal to about 105% of the amount of money that they would borrow from us on a CD. And the collateral is placed with a third-party institution, so that if a bank should fail or should there be any problem, we don't have to go begging to the failed institution for our collateral. It's already held by a third party, and we just seize it. That program is about a $300 million program. About $200 million of it was used, and as the banking system in Alaska started to fail, slowly a lot of that money was paid back. Our experience with that program, with all the bank failure that we had, is that we did not lose a cent of interest, nor did we lose a cent of principal. The structure was such that there was no way that we could lose money as long as that collateral was worthwhile. Today, that program has been drawn upon from a high of about $200 million to today of about $88 million. So that there's $212 million available for Alaskan banking institutions to draw at any time. That's essentially three-year money at a floating rate, so it's construction period money. It's not takeout money, long-term takeout. It will, however, fund any construction project, assuming that the duration is not going to exceed 3 years. When we loan that money to banks, we charge our interest rate and we insist on collateral, but we do not interfere with the banks as to what they do with that money in terms of what interest rates they charge or the terms and conditions. This is strictly a bottom-line entrepreneurial deal. Because of the availability of this $300 million, of which only $88 million has been used, there really is no shortage of money in Alaska, either from our source, us as a source, and we're not the cheapest source, or from the Federal Reserve. The main problem in Alaska today is the fact that credit has been weakened. And while banks would prefer sometimes to tell potential clients or clients that they just don't have any money, what they really don't want to tell a good client over the years is that his credit has gone sour and they just don't want to lend to him. So that program is one that works and is available for Alaska economic development, but has not been used simply because of the present credit status of a lot of our citizenry and businesses. Another program is a home mortgage program where we do loan money for individual home mortgages. That's a program we'd like to stop. A permanent fund organization, institution like us, should not be worrying about $80,000 or $100,000 loans to individuals. We would prefer that people borrowed from banks or from Alaska Housing Finance, if they want to put those things into a block of $1 million or $2 million represented by Ginnie Mae's, which are direct obligations of the U.S., we would rather buy Ginnie Mae's, which in turn are securities that represent all of the mortgages. And we do that. We buy a lot of Ginnie Mae's. A third program we involve in Alaska is the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation program, whereby we generally buy 10% of every new issue of Alaska Housing Finance bonds, provided they're taxable issues. If they issue tax-exempt debt, obviously we're not interested because the return is not a very beneficial one. But we do buy 10% of every new issue of taxable issue of Alaska Housing Finance. We help to make a market for it. Over the years, we probably bought hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Alaska Housing Finance paper. Our present inventory is somewhere between $6 or $9 billion. Classically, what happens is we make a market for it. We take those bonds into inventory, and when the markets turn beneficial to us, we sell them out and we make a profit. We also clear the deck so we can buy more. That way, we don't overload our portfolios with Alaska Housing Finance debt. We take them in, make the accommodation, sell them at a profit, and everybody gains all the time. So that's basically the Alaska frontier with respect to investing. We would, if the Alaska Industrial Development Authority were able to issue taxable debt, and they can, but they just haven't. If they were to issue taxable debt for major projects and it were AA rated, as is HFC, we would be 10% buyers of every Alaska Industrial Development Authority issue. And we could assist Alaska in that regard. But we always look at it as an investment program. We don't look at it as a social or political program in any way. It's always to our bottom line benefit. If we can't make a buck on it, we're really, frankly, not interested in it. So, Mr. Chairman, that's sort of where we are at the Alaska scene. Let's move on to page 8. 8, again, is a chart that indicates the growth of fund principal. You can see a steady increase both through inflation proofing and new money in from the oil patch. Nothing really dramatic, just a steady increase and no losses, which is the most important thing. That our charge is to make sure that we don't lose any of this the seed corn or this nest egg. With respect to the sources of principal, at 30 June 1990, we had $9.9 billion in the fund, $9.9 billion. 39% of it, $3,831,000,000, came from the oil patch by dint of the constitutional amendment, 25% of oil revenues. But 61% of all of the principal that went into the fund actually was derived from the legislature. And I know sometimes you folks say, gee, why doesn't everyone ever give us credit for this? 21% comes from inflation proofing. Inflation proofing is not constitutionally mandated, it's statutorily mandated. So over $2 billion has flowed to the fund from the statutory mandate. There's also an accompanying appropriation now. It weren't in the early years, it was just a statute. 40% have come from special legislative appropriations. Those are in three pieces. In 1980, $900 million. Remembrance of the Prudhoe Bay $900 million a full decade earlier. In 1981, an appropriation of $1.8 billion. Now, that was not paid in 1 year. It was paid out over the next 4 years, but it was received. And there was an appropriation of surplus that the fund had earned. We had earned $1.2 billion in excess of the needs for dividend and inflation proofing, and the legislature appropriated all of that surplus to the principal of the fund as a gift. And I think that was in 86, I think, July of 86. So that when you look at the pattern of what's gone into the fund, true, almost 40% has come in from the oil patch, but 60% has really come through the legislative action and legislative initiative, which was not required by constitutional action. We'd like to think that we've helped you make those decisions along the way, and we'll continue to offer our services if that will help. This chart 10, which is unfortunately not a colored chart, but is supposed to indicate to you that the sources of money comes in sort of a lumpy fashion. It's not consistently one thing or another. Some of those large spikes are the appropriations. The shaded, of course, is inflation proofing, which is now more regular. And if you look at 1990, and 88 and 89, I guess, it becomes apparent now that the real growth of the fund is only going to come from new oil money that comes in. Inflation proofing is becoming more and more of a dominant amount of money that adds money to the fund in nominal terms. But because inflation proofing only keeps you abreast with what's happening, there's no real growth. The only real growth to the fund occurs with respect to the dedicated revenues, the oil patch money. And unless we see some major settlements or major windfalls, this fund will not grow in real terms unless there's an appropriation of some of that windfall or new money. The chart 11 is the net income, and again, net income is a very steady, even amount. This is cash. This is cash income. Approaching last year was $916 million in cash. This year, unless there are our unusual market operations, we expect the cash will be about $933 million. Paper profits would be on top of that. You can see in 86 and 87, those 2 years when we sold stocks and took some bonds first in 86 and took profits, sold stock in 87 and took profits. Again, unusual this year, however, may be an interesting year in terms of profit taking. If we have a recession, our bonds will be very valuable. And if that recession bottoms out in May, we probably would sell some of our bonds and take those profits. If the recession bottomed out in August, we would do it then. So we can't tell you whether our profits will be magnificent this year or just ordinary. But we would suspect that from the shape of our portfolio, that we probably would take some capital gains in either the May, June, July, or August period, that four-month span. But we can't be more precise at that time. And then you'll see another unusual hump. But again, that's not normal.
Jim Meyer. Well, thanks, Chairman. Permanent fund dividend formula is based on net income.
Yes, it is.
Versus
it's a real. It's a based on the cash on that activity. So that if there were a rather large bump in income this year, that's factored into the five-year rolling formula that we have, and it might have a small influence on dividends. But it would be a small one. It would not be a great one because of the five-year averaging formula that we have.
What do you consider real income versus net?
Real income being cash as opposed to total income. This is real. But we use two terms. One is net income by the statute, which is the cash. Total income, which involves cash plus all the paper profits. Paper profits don't count in the calculation. For example, there have been years where we earned $1.6 billion, but only $1 billion of that has been cash, and the rest of it has been paper profits. We account in two methods, really. But for the dividend program, we calculate it only on cash, which is net income, as we say.
Excuse me, there is one other term that sometimes used called real income. There was some bills introduced last year in the legislature relating to real income. Proposals to change the dividend formula to basically real income. In that context, real income meant net income minus inflation.
Okay, let's go on to chart 13 just indicates income that's been added to principal. You can see that inflation proofing has gone in amounts in the 200 to 400 million area. But there was that $1,264,000,000 of income that was added to principal by appropriation. Generally, we've earned about $2 billion more than we have needed for dividends and for inflation proofing over the years. But of course, we use some of that reserve, so if in any 1 year we don't have enough money for inflation proofing and dividends, we can draw into it. We've only had to draw into it once to the extent of about $30 million, but we've added to it many years to the extent of almost $2 billion. So we, over time, have generally earned more than we've needed for inflation proofing and dividends. The page 14 indicates the amount of money transferred to the dividend fund. Now, I'm sure you're all aware that the Permanent Fund Corporation does not manage the dividend fund program. The dividend is managed by the Department of Revenue. What we do is we just do a wire transfer once a year of a big block of money to the state of Alaska Department of Revenue. And the department then determines who's eligible and what checks go out and when they go out, and they do all the audit functions. So our job essentially is to earn the money and turn over that one check to the state Department of Revenue. In 1990, we sent over $487 million, and that was broken up for some operating expenses, but of course, great preponderance for dividends and went out to every man, woman, and child. We try to stay away from the dividend program in terms of dealing with individuals. That is the Department of Revenue's function. But we get an awful lot of phone calls, as does the department, as you can imagine, with people who haven't gotten a check and they've got a problem. The department is generally very good about following up on that. The chart on 15 shows you the per capita dividend payments. we don't show 1990 on this chart, but you can see that the interesting thing about this chart is that in 82 and in 83, part of the money came from the general fund. It wasn't until 84 that 100% of the dividends were made up from the corporation's earnings, so that you can that dip from $1,000 down to $386 was a function of an appropriation out of the general fund, but the $331 forward are 100% derived from the operations of the permanent fund itself. page 16, very briefly, is just shows the over the years what we call above and below water. When those bars are above the line, it means the fund is worth more than we paid for it. There are some years when actually that fund has not been worth what we have paid for it. The cost has exceeded the market value. But in recent years, you can see, and we would expect it would continue, the fund is worth considerably more than what we paid for it. I think maybe I ought to end at this point. We have a lot of data on performance and what have you. If you would turn to page 22, however, this is a composite since the fund has been in existence. And you can see that 11.4% has been the rate of return, the nominal rate of return that we've earned on cash. The inflation rate over all this period has been 6.2%, relatively high. If you take 11.4 as your nominal return, you subtract inflation from it, and then you're left with a real return of 5.2%. Typically, for an endowment or pension or other fund, over a period of time, if you can earn a 3% real rate of return, you've done very handsomely. Because most of the fund has existed in the decade of the 80s, it has been just a marvelous decade for investors. The skew toward 5.2% as opposed to a 3%, which would be considered good, is not an unusual one. I mean, the industry has produced these kinds of returns. So we wouldn't want to mislead you that you know, your fund management walks on water. We've done what the rest of the industry has done pretty much. We do not expect that we'd be able to continue to earn 5.2% over this next decade. But of course, you know, we don't know. We spend a lot of time as your fund managers trying not to do stupid things. A lot of this is self-defense. I'm not so sure that we do a lot of smart things, but we do spend a lot of time on self-defense. Which brings me to another topic. There may be other questions that you haven't here, and we can certainly get to them. One question was asked, talking about self-defense, in the Senate letter to us. The question was, what have you done with respect to the war? And if you would turn to table Q3, which it should be about the third or fourth page in this document, it became apparent to us very early on that the markets would be very volatile as a result of the Middle East crisis. On November 9th, I decided that I would put the organization on a 24-hour basis. As you know, we open the office at about 5:30 in the morning, which picks up a little bit of the London close and all of the New York activity. Tokyo comes on at about 3:15 to 3:30 in the afternoon and goes on into the night. Generally, our office is open from 5:30 in the morning till about 6 at night. So we cover all of the markets to some degree. But we also leave on call with certain people around the world the ability to call us at home if something happens in London or something happens in Tokyo later in the evening. We went to a 24-hour coverage to make sure that there was always somebody on call and available at a telephone so that if anything did happen with respect to world markets, we would be able to react. You know, on November 15th, we were slated to buy a substantial amount of equities, a certain amount of stock, actually $100 million in the foreign markets. We delivered that $100 million, but we put a hold on whether or not those transactions would go through. And eventually, we did release that $100 million and buy some of those foreign stocks. We continued a series of daily meetings or every other day meetings at about 7 in the morning to talk about the war events and strategies. And nothing significant happened until about December 26th. We had the folks who managed some of our money put on what we call a no-cash basis. In other words, we want you to be fully invested. We don't want you to hold out cash because you think the markets are in trouble. As war became imminent, it became clear that there may be a need for these folks not to be fully invested. They may have to hold some cash. So we removed that suspension. We gave them discretion to hold in those accounts both stock and cash. So if in their discretion there was a need to hold cash, they could do so. On December 27th, we reviewed what we'd be doing. We had been doing. We decided we would continue the 24-hour coverage. And we had another series of special strategy meetings with respect to where we thought the market would go if indeed there were hostilities. On December 31st, we did two things. It became apparent to us that the market would tend to drop for a number of reasons, from earnings to war jitters. And so on December 31st, we liquidated about $150 million in stock from our portfolio. We had only liquidated money in high amounts once before, and that was early in 87, when we were concerned about the potential for the drop and crash in the market, and that did occur late in 87. We were a little bit early on that, but we did it early. So we did liquidate about $150 million. The Dow Jones at that time was about 26.33. We also decided to hedge some yen. It became apparent to us that while we had substantial gains in the foreign portfolios because the dollar had fallen substantially against other currencies, and since we hold 17 other currencies in our portfolio, stocks representing 17 currencies, if there was war and there was a flight to quality, people would start to buy gold, people would start to buy dollars, then the paper profits that we had in our foreign portfolios would fall dramatically. And so in the prospect that the dollar would appreciate, we went ahead and we sold $1.3 billion yen, and we did that as a hedge to protect some of those paper profits. We continued our series of meetings until January 7th. Again, we had to talk about whether or not we would fund our managers on the 15th of that month. Again, another increment of money going to buy new stock. On January 7th, we made the decision that we would not put any more money in the stock market, certainly not on the 15th of the month when that was the deadline for war. So we did not fund those folks. On January 16th, which was, that is January 16th, our time at about 7:20 in the morning, which is about 7:20 at night on the 16th in Kuwait, we had to determine whether or not we thought that war was imminent and was going to break out and what the effect would be. In calling our colleagues around the country and indeed around the world, it became pretty apparent that everybody was sitting on the sidelines. They thought at the first shot, the market would fall dramatically, and then everybody in the world would jump in and buy low. It became apparent to us that there were so many people, almost $2 billion worth of money waiting on the sidelines, that indeed when that first shot was fired, probably nobody would buy low. Everybody would be in the market. We didn't then wait for the first shot to be fired at about 7:20 in the morning of the 16th. We ordered the repurchase of $150 million in securities. We had sold that 150 at about 26.33. We were able to rebuy them at the Dow at about 24.95. And of course, what happened is not only did the market go down for those first 16 days and we were going from 26.33 to 24.95, but since then, of course, the market has gone straight up and now it's about 2,900, give or take today's activity. So while we don't normally engage in market-type activity because of the war concerns and our strategies, and you see the strategy changed. We thought we thought the market would drop precipitously at war, and our later intelligence indicated that it did not. To make a long story short, we were able to secure some nice gains for the fund, but this meant really staying up around the clock and covering the eventualities of war. The only other thing we have done is we are partners with the Kingdom of Kuwait in some of our investments. And although we are a very open public information fund, I did embargo any information with respect to our investments with the Kingdom of Kuwait. They're basically real estate ventures. And for fear that they might either be subject to terrorism or other acts of vandalism, we have embargoed from our organization all information relative to those co-investments with the Kingdom of Kuwait. Ordinarily, that would be public information, but we think under the current situation, neither Kuwait doesn't tell everybody what they own, and we think it's probably proper at this time that we don't disclose that either. So that's sort of the rundown of the extra adrenaline that's pumped this last 60 days. I want to share that with you because it is a little bit unique for the fund, because we're not market players ordinarily. We don't play the market. I think, Mr. Chairman, given the time, that I'd probably be most fruitful if I answered questions rather than rambled on with more stuff.
Representative Brockman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, a quick question. Who makes those decisions when you're monitoring 24 hours a day? Is it you?
I do. My staff.
too many people? Too many people?
I have one investment officer for debt, one for stock, one for real estate, myself, and my deputy, Bob Maynard, is also my currency manager.
So
Bob worries about currency fluctuation throughout the world. So there are essentially five of us on the investment staff. And generally, those decisions are either by consensus, and if there's no consensus, then I make them.
Okay.
Ultimately, I'm the responsible person, because these people report to me. If there's any conflict, I always make the resolving decision.
Mm-hmm. In other words, you're available 24 hours a day on call.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Okay, this has been an eye-opener, and I appreciate your
response. We would hope it wouldn't continue for too long.
We know what we get from oil. We get, we've got a pattern of how much we're getting. If the gas pipeline is built, there's obviously not as much money involved there. Is that going to be much of an increase there for the
money? Were the gas pipeline to be utilized, there would be significant revenues to the state of Alaska and the fund. I couldn't quantify them, frankly, Mr. Chairman, but that is a function of market. And that gas pipeline will come on in either two lifts. One, because the national market for gas is such that it's profitable. Or number two, some far eastern entity is willing to pay above market for that gas as long as there's a guaranteed long supply. So, if somebody had a guaranteed 15-year supply, they may be willing to pay a premium over market for that. It would appear that on the short term, the biggest opportunity for this fund to grow would be the development of ANWR, very quickly. Because ANWR would be a new field, 50% of the royalties on ANWR would flow to the permanent fund, 50%. That's a statutory requirement. So that the fund has a very strong emotional stake in ANWR development.
Are you looking for the legislature to do anything this year to help the fund?
We have two things. Number one, of course, we have a technical bill which has been introduced by Senator Pouchot on the Senate side. Is there a House?
No.
Equivalent? There's not. When our statute was put together, it was put together over 4 long years and in bits and pieces. It's a difficult statute to follow, and this is really a technical amendment bill. There's nothing in there that is major policy change. But it would certainly help if we had a clean statute to act from. The second part, of course, is the budget, which is our operating budget, which, as I've indicated, we operate very much like a private sector entity. We have a budget that's been put in by our trustees that is not back to legislative budget and audit and to anybody we can talk to and say, We've tried to do whatever we can, but if we can't do it, we'll come back to the well and tell you what the problems are.
So your funding, you don't just pay for your department out of profits. You actually have to get appropriated just like everybody else.
Yes. The money, of course, that we use is out of our profits. But the oversight that the legislature has is my mea culpa, my staff's mea culpa every year begging for money. I mean, that's the real oversight that the legislature has, and we don't recommend that you do away with that. Our only concern is that we not be micromanaged. It is difficult sometimes when you're dealing with little compartments of personnel and travel and contractual. I'm the kind of a manager who would rather have a block of money and say, take this block of money and manage your corporation, and we're not going to worry about how much you spend on X, Y, or Z. Unfortunately, that's not the way the State Budget Act works. That would be our preference, obviously.
Where were the cuts made in general? Was it personnel?
Personnel and travel. We were treated equally with everybody else on across the board budget effect. No greater numbers.
Questions from the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I presume now that your board members do not require legislative confirmation.
That's correct, they do not.
What's the board's feeling, or your feeling on requiring legislative confirmation of board members?
I'm not sure whether it makes a difference one way or the other. You give me good board members, great board members, that's wonderful. Give me terrible ones, I probably wouldn't be so enthusiastic about them being locked in for a long period of time. I can't really help you on that, Tom. That's a policy question that you guys got to deal with.
Anything else?
Nope. Thanks, Dave.
If not, we just want to encourage you to come by anytime you have a question or call. We're more than glad to share with you what we know. We don't always know a great deal, but you're all welcome. You really are.
thank you
for the courtesy.
I appreciate it.